this is a test. Make sure the... Well, I'll call our gathering to order now. My name is Tom Berger, and I'm the chairman of the Alaska Native Review Commission. And this is the third week of our overview hearings here in Anchorage. We expect others to arrive this afternoon and this evening for the overview, and we may tomorrow morning, once we have a full house, have to rearrange the round table, but we'll leave that until tomorrow to worry about. This commission was established by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference to examine the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. That was the landmark settlement of Native claims in the modern era. It is well known, I think, to all of you. And the job given to this commission is to examine how the Alaska settlement has worked out, and to do that in the broadest context, and to consider what lessons have been learned in Alaska that will be useful to Aboriginal peoples in other countries, and to governments in other countries for that matter. And we have asked all of you here so that Alaska Natives and Alaskans generally can benefit from your experience in these matters, your own history with regard to land claims and issues relating to Native self-government in your own countries. This commission will, once these overview hearings are completed this week, be spending the rest of its time for the next 12 months in the villages of Alaska. There are approximately 200 villages in Alaska, and the largest proportion of Alaska Natives live in those villages, and this commission will be going there to hear what those people have to say about the settlement of 1971, its impact on their villages and on their lives, and the directions that they may wish to take now and in the years that lie ahead. Well, I think that I owe it to you to tell you what we've been talking about here for the last 2 weeks. During the first week of the overview hearings, we had Native people and leaders from Alaska who told us what they were trying to achieve when they worked for a settlement of Native land claims back in the late 60s and early 70s. What was it they wanted that settlement back in 1971 to do for Alaska Natives? We've had representatives of the congressional staff, some of those who were responsible for drafting portions of the Claims Act, and representatives of the Alaska state government at the time, and they've been here to talk about what it was Congress, the Congress of the United States, was trying to achieve in the Claims Act. And they all agree on what the settlement did. They don't altogether agree on the way it's worked out. But under the settlement here in Alaska in 1971, 44 million acres of land were to be conveyed to the Alaska Native people, and they were to receive $962.5 million. Now, the people themselves weren't to receive the land and the money. It was to be conveyed, the land was to be conveyed to 12 regional corporations and 200 village corporations, and the land was conveyed in fee simple, what I think we would all call freehold. The subsurface rights, however, were to be held by the regional corporations, the 12 regional corporations. That is, they were to hold, and they do hold, subsurface rights to all the land, whether it is land conveyed to the regional corporations or to the village corporations. And each Alaska Native who participates in the settlement received 100 shares in his regional corporation and 100 shares in his village corporation. So the Alaska Natives who participated in the settlement back in 1971 became shareholders in these corporations, and it is the corporations that receive the money and that hold Native ancestral lands. Now, looking back, I think it is fair to describe the settlement as a landmark achievement. The corporations have been the means of holding and consolidating Native ancestral lands, and the money available to them together with the land has given them economic power in the state, and thereby a certain measure and a substantial measure, I believe, of political influence. Now, it is apparent from the hearings that we have held already that land was, in 1971, the most important concern of Alaska Natives, and land is still the most important concern they have today. The land, however, is not their land. That is an expression used by Byron Malott, president of Sea Alaska Corporation, one of the regional for-profit corporations. Mr. Malott came to these hearings during the first week and expressed the dilemma that the corporations face, in that they are, on the one hand, for-profit corporations. Their purpose in life is to make a profit. The land then that they hold is for their purposes an economic asset, and yet in very large measure, from the point of view of people in village Alaska, Native people living in the villages, the land is regarded by them as a heritage to be passed on to their children, and it is regarded by them as to be devoted primarily to subsistence hunting and fishing activities, which do not usually generate a profit, and are not on the balance sheet of the corporations something that falls within the category normally of an economic asset. Now, Mr. Malott made the point that the corporations have not divested themselves of the land. That is, the uses to which they have devoted the land may not always be consistent with subsistence uses, but they have not divested themselves of the land, although there is nothing to prevent them selling it, or they may indeed lose it if they are unable to pay their debts and go into bankruptcy. But the point should be made that the corporations have not, in the 12 years that have passed since the settlement was made, have not divested themselves of any substantial parcels of land. Now, the land may, in 1991, or thereafter be lost because the land that the corporations hold is not subject to property tax, but it does become subject to property tax 20 years after conveyance. So in 1991 and in the years that follow, the land may become subject to tax and could be lost. These are theoretical propositions, but they have been discussed at length here. Could be lost through tax sales. Now, these corporations are shareholder corporations, not membership corporations. Only native persons were entitled to be enrolled as shareholders in 1971. They cannot sell their shares until 1991. That is, for 20 years, they are restricted in the sale of their shares. They cannot sell them to anyone, although their children may take by inheritance, and others may take by inheritance, though they cannot vote their shares. But there is concern here in Alaska that in 1991, when the shares become transferable, when Alaska natives who hold shares can sell them, that some may, for one reason or another, sell them, and that the corporations and the lands they hold could become the subject of takeover bids, and thus the corporations and the lands could be lost. Furthermore, the only persons to whom shares were sold, to whom shares were issued in 1971, were those native persons living in 1971. So all Alaska natives born since 1971 are not entitled to be enrolled, although they may take, as I say, by inheritance. Now this means that children of Alaska natives who are less than 12 years of age are not entitled to be enrolled as shareholders in the corporations. All of these are grave concerns to Alaska natives. Under the Claims Act, under the settlement, their children do not share in the settlement as of right, and after 1991 they may lose the land through loss of corporate control or through tax sales. Now, in describing the settlement that was made in 1971, I've emphasized the corporations. These are economic institutions, but they have had to serve, in a sense, as political institutions as well, because no political institutions were established by the Claims Act. It's called ANCSA, A-N-C-S-A, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and many around the table will refer to it as ANCSA, the Claims Act, the Settlement Act. It's all the same thing. At any rate, the issue of political institutions, of political autonomy, was not addressed by the Act. But now this question of political autonomy has become an issue in Alaska, and many Alaska natives are urging that traditional tribal governments tribal governments established under federal legislation, they are known as IRAs, should become the central institutions of native government here in Alaska, and some have gone so far as to urge that the corporations should transfer the native lands they hold to the tribal governments to ensure that the land remains in native hands, even if the corporations do not. So last week and the week before, there was much discussion about the advantages and disadvantages of tribal governments and about the reservation system in the lower 48. Because last week we invited native leaders, lawyers, and scholars from the lower 48 to come to discuss these questions. Now, we here in Alaska have observed that there is a worldwide movement by indigenous people, by Aboriginal peoples, for self-sufficiency and self-determination. And we hope that you will tell us what is taking place in your own countries in furtherance of that movement by Aboriginal peoples towards self-sufficiency and self-determination. Now, that movement exists here in Alaska, And during the first week of these hearings, Charles Johnson, who is president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, expressed the desire of Alaska Natives not to be just citizens of the United States of America, but to be Native people as well, a distinct people in America with their own institutions. Now, Mr. Johnson felt that the Native corporations here in Alaska were a sufficient expression of that desire for Native institutions. Mr. Sheldon Kachetag, on the other hand, who is here today, Vice President of the United Tribes of Alaska, speaking for his organization, takes the view that Native institutions must be political institutions, that is, they must have lawmaking authority, authority derived from the limited sovereignty that tribal governments possess as domestic dependent nations under United States law. And many non-natives in the state of Alaska, and native people in the state of Alaska constitute approximately 15 or 16% of the population, and non-native people in the state of Alaska, many of them oppose distinct political institutions for Alaska natives. They believe that that the native people should, as citizens of Alaska, participate in state-chartered city and borough governments as other citizens do, and that these state institutions are sufficient. Now, we understand that in Greenland, the Eskimos are a majority in that country, and that the premier and the cabinet are Eskimos, and that the Eskimo people predominate in the government of that country, but that the government is nevertheless one in which non-native people, people of European descent, are entitled to play an equal part with the Eskimo majority. We will, I hope, hear not only about the movement towards home rule in Greenland and its outcome. I hope we will also hear from the Eskimos in Canada, and I use the word Eskimos to embrace the people who may be Yupik or Inupiat or Inuvialuit or Inuit who extend right across the Arctic. We want to hear from the representatives of the Eskimos in the central and eastern Arctic region of Canada about their plans to establish a new territory with a predominantly Eskimo population and the means they intend to take to accommodate the non-native population, the population of European descent, the means they intend to offer them to participate in that government. In any event, arguments about self-rule and sovereignty have arisen here in Alaska, and they seem to be intertwined with the issues about what is to happen in 1991. At any rate, they seem to be given a special kind of urgency by reason of the felt necessity to make provision to avoid the consequences that people believe lie in wait in 1991. Now, we want to hear from all of you how land claims have fared in your countries, and how the movement for self-rule and self-government has fared, and whether it has taken the form of a movement to establish distinctly Native institutions in which non-Native people do not participate, or whether, as in Greenland, in the central and eastern Arctic region of Canada, the movement is rather one for governmental institutions in which, although Native people are the majority, non-Native people have the right to participate. Well, last week, the second week of our overview, Native leaders from the Lower 48, legal scholars and others concerned with the humanities, discussed the policies of the United States of America towards Native Americans in the Lower 48. Professor Joe Jorgensen of the University of California discussed these policies from the founding of the United States of America to the present. He said that U.S. policy had followed a roller coaster, at one era inclined to recognize the distinct nature of native claims and native institutions, and then in another era unwilling to recognize the distinct character of native institutions and native claims. That roller coaster has continued into this century and into our own time, and Ada Deer of the Menominee tribe in Wisconsin spoke of the history of that tribe in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s of their termination by the United States government, and then of their struggle for restoration of their tribal government and tribal institutions achieved in the 1970s. Professor Ralph Johnson told us last week that there has been, during the past 10 years, acknowledgement of the right of Native Americans to govern themselves through their own tribal governments. This at least has been so in the lower 48, and he said that this has been affirmed by legislation enacted by every administration during the 1970s and 1980s, and by a series of decisions of the Supreme Court of the United States during the same period. Now, most of those who came from the lower 48 were dubious about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. For instance, Kim Gottschalk, a lawyer with the Native American Rights Fund, said that it should be regarded as likely to end in the loss of Alaska Native land, and he felt it was out of keeping with the movement in the lower 48 by Native Americans for a greater measure of Native autonomy. Professor Ralph Johnson and Tim Coulter of the Native American Resource Council in Washington, D.C., I spoke of the movement to extend the powers of tribal governments during the past decade. Some of these powers exercisable by tribal governments include the power to determine who is a member of the tribe, the power to tax certain civil and criminal jurisdiction, including child welfare, jurisdiction over the use of water on reservation lands, jurisdiction to enact building codes, zoning measures, and to establish preferences for native hire by tribal governments. I think I should add that in Canada constitution adopted by Canada in 1982 provided for explicit recognition and affirmation of the rights of the Aboriginal peoples. In a report subscribed to by all parties in the Canadian Parliament in November last year, it was agreed that that Native governments in Canada should be recognized as a third order of government, along with the federal government and the governments of the provinces. And there was a constitutional conference in Canada last week relating to Native rights, and we will ask none of us were there, we will ask the Canadian representatives at this conference to tell us more about that as the week goes on. We were also told that there has been a movement for the restoration of sacred places in the lower 48 and throughout the world. Russell Jim of the Yakima tribe spoke of the restoration of a sacred mountain in Washington State to the Yakima people. Tito Naranjo of the Pueblos of New Mexico spoke of the restoration of Blue Lake, the Pueblos Lake of Emergence, and we have heard of the restoration in Australia of Ayers Rock to the Aboriginal people of that country. Now, last week we were reminded, however, that in the United States there is a large body of opinion that looks with disfavor on the idea that Native people should have their own governments, that does not look with favor on the idea that they should have their own land free from taxation, or for that matter, their own native corporations. Many people in the United States and in other countries are opposed to what they regard as a nation within a nation, a state within a state. They say that all should have equal rights and that these rights can only be claimed by individuals. And Professor Lerner from the University of Chicago told us last week that this was the genius of the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights, that everyone has equality of rights under the law, but that these rights can only be claimed by individuals, and that Indian tribes and Indian people can no more claim rights belonging to them as a class or as a tribe than the Irish in America or the Italians, the Ukrainians, or the Chinese in America could claim the right to their own government and their own land free from taxation or their own corporate structures. And this reflects a widely held view that uniformity in language, customs, religion, and culture is a good thing, and that diversity is bad, at least that diversity should not be given institutional or constitutional recognition. Well, we want to know to what extent you, who come from Canada and Greenland and Norway and Australia, have encountered this argument, and what arguments have been advanced on your side to meet that argument, or if it be so, whether you have accepted the validity of that argument and have ceased to try to persuade those who accept it. In Norway, we have been told that Professor Carsten Smith is completing a report on the land rights of the Sami people of Norway, of whom there are 40,000, and we hope to hear about their movement for land rights and indeed as well their movement to achieve a measure of self-government. We want to know what arrangements you have made in your own countries for preservation of ancestral lands. Is your land held in trust by your national government for native people? Is it held by native corporations? If you have native corporations, are they shareholders' corporations in which everybody holds shares, or are they membership corporations in which every tribal member is entitled to participate? Are the political institutions that you have established public governments in which natives and non-natives have the right to full participation, or are they native governments restricted to native persons? To what extent in all of this have you followed or rejected the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Model of 1971? And we hope that in the course of these 4 days, we will hear about the settlement in James Bay and northern Quebec in 1975, the settlement in the Mackenzie Delta that is apparently even now being considered by the government of Canada and the Inuit people in the Mackenzie Valley, Mackenzie Delta. We hope to hear about the settlement that has been reached in the Yukon by the Council of Yukon Indians and the government of Canada. We hope to hear about the land claims that are being advanced by the Dene Nation in the Mackenzie Valley and by the Inuit Tupiriçat of Canada in the central and eastern Arctic. We hope from Greenland to hear the story of home rule and how far land claims have been settled in Greenland and what proposals the Eskimos of Greenland are advancing for settlement. From Norway, we hope to hear about the movement of the Sami for land rights in Norway and in other Scandinavian countries. And in Australia, we hope to hear of the national struggle for land rights by the Aboriginal people of Australia, and in particular, to hear of developments in the Northern Territory and in Western Australia. And all that is said here today and for the remainder of the week is transcribed on the audio equipment, and a transcript will be made, and the record will be a permanent record available to all of us in future. And I hope that we will learn much from one another. Perhaps I should say that these television cameras are here not only to record what is said, but for the purposes of developing television programs. When these overview hearings are completed later this week, we will, this commission, which is focusing on Alaska land claims, will resume its meetings in the villages throughout Alaska. That work will take us into 1985, and I will write a report in 1985 that we hope will be of use to Alaska natives and to Aboriginal peoples in the countries that all of you represent here. I think that I might, for the record, just list the people that we have here already today. Maureen Kelly is here from Pilbara Land Council, Marble Bar, Western Australia. Shorty O'Neill from the National Land Council in Australia. The delegates from Canada are not here in force, but they have sent Sam Silverstone, legal counsel to Makovic Corporation, the Inuit Corporation in Quebec. And from Alberta, Alex Redcrow and Ron Laneman are here, and they have been working with the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous Peoples in Geneva. From Norway, we welcome Alf Isaac Keskitalo of the Sami Institute. And from the United States, especially Alaska, Don Mitchell, who served for some considerable time as Vice President of the Alaska Federation of Natives and is a well-known figure in the Alaska land claims movement and legal advisor to Native people, is here. And Sheldon Kachetag, Vice President of the United Tribes of Alaska, and Daly Sambo of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, as well Alfred Starr, an Athabascan elder who was an early proponent of land rights for Native people here in Alaska, Charlie Edwardson Jr., who was one of the key figures in the struggle for ANCSA back in the late 60s and early 70s, and as well David Case, who is professor at the University of Alaska and is legal advisor to this commission, and Chuck Smythe, an anthropologist here in Alaska who is working with the commission. Tomorrow morning when we have the aircraft schedules and the weather permitting a full house, I may take the liberty of introducing all of you again. Now, we have asked Professor Doug Sanders of the University of British Columbia, who is legal counsel to the World Council of Indigenous People, to open the discussion today, and his paper about the reemergence of Native rights in international law was circulated to all of you. And we will ask Doug to begin by discussing his paper, and after that we will have a coffee break, and we will then ask some of you to contribute to the discussion after that. Doug, with that perhaps less than adequate introduction, would you open the discussion?
Thank you. I might note, Mr. Commissioner, that this is our 20th anniversary, It was 20 years ago that I began to work with you in a small law firm in Vancouver. And
now we're both unemployed.
Much has changed since then, but you're still the one presiding.
Let it remain so.
Two documents have been circulated, a paper that I've written called The Reemergence of Indigenous Questions in International Law, and a briefer document at the end of that entitled Comparative and International Chronology of Indigenous Rights. I will be roughly following the chronology rather than the paper, which is more a background document. One of the central theses in the longer paper is that the question of indigenous rights was regarded as an international law question in the early days of European colonial expansion. In the 16th century, the writings of the fathers, as they are called, of international law, clearly treated the question of indigenous rights as a question of international law. Now, international law was not truly international. It was the product of the Western European colonial states. It was designed to resolve conflicts between them and not designed to create any kind of balance between rights of colonized populations and rights acquired by colonial powers. It wasn't truly international then. In the period since the Second World War, we've had very significant arguments by Third World nations that it still is not truly international in our time. What happened with international law was that, having treated the question of questions of indigenous rights as true international law questions, that element of international law was then rather unceremoniously dumped. Colonialism became so extensive and so successful in terms of the Western European powers that they ceased to regard the questions of indigenous rights as international law questions. And the mark of this success or this achievement of power was the redefinition in international law of indigenous questions as being domestic. They were internalized. They were not subject to any kind of international principles, any kind of international scrutiny, any kind of international standards. International law traditionally has been basically the law governing the relationship between nation states, with the nation states being restricted to those national entities which recognized each other. Tribal populations and indigenous populations were excluded from this essentially Eurocentric analysis of the relationship between peoples and between populations. So it became a standard. There were some anomalies, because there were documents such as the document in Fiji acceding to British sovereignty in Fiji. And there were the treaties in North America. But these anomalies were not treated as being real anomalies. The documents involved were treated as less than international law documents, the transactions as less than international law transactions. By international law, all of these matters were domestic matters, therefore they were not subject to international scrutiny. There was a development in international law in the late 19th century, the evolution of an extensive set of international institutions, and the gradual extension of international law into fields that it had not been involved in before, some simply responding to technological change, the development of more trade and more communications. It's only significantly since the Second World War that international law has extended into areas that were previously described as being domestic, internal social questions. Human rights entered the international law, most noticeably after the Second World War, but following the dominant pattern of human rights concerns in the traditions of the United States, that is, of focusing on individual human rights and not on collective rights or on the rights of minorities. We have gotten to the point today where it is increasingly accepted that it is not adequate to look at indigenous questions solely in domestic law terms. The old framework is no longer adequate. In 1973, Professor Louis Sohn, S-O-H-N, the distinguished United States expert on the international law of human rights, stated that the subject of the human rights of indigenous peoples was, quote, clearly on the agenda of the world community, end of quote. And the very fact that this set of hearings is being held this week, the character of the hearings this week, testifies that at least some of the people connected with this inquiry and connected with indigenous questions in Alaska have rejected the view that these questions are solely domestic. There are two ways of seeing it, and they're not solely comparative. Because if they were seen as solely comparative, then one would look at other countries out of interest, because perhaps other countries have some lessons to teach you. But it's only a comparative examination. There's no compulsion to follow what's going on in any other country of the world. One of the major characteristics of international law, as it is developed in at least the Western traditions, has been that it's a kind of summing up of minimum standards of behavior on the part of nation states. And so in our time, there is a question as to whether certain minimum standards of treatment of indigenous populations have now come to be accepted by nation states and scholars as appropriate in relation to indigenous populations. For if that can be said, then in purely orthodox international law terms, there is then a base on which the formulation of international standards is possible. On the basis not of new conventions, but on the basis of customary international law. That is the recording of a minimum consensus which has developed. There are two forms of international law. Customary international law, on which I suggest certain standards could now be derived. As well, there is conventional international law, which is international law which is based on agreements, treaties, conventions, and agreements. There is, among certain figures active at the international level, a kind of generalized agenda that certain standards for the treatment of indigenous populations are being and are to continue to be developed in the anticipation of leading to some resolution of the General Assembly or some convention which would deal with standards for the treatment of indigenous populations. We're very clearly in the middle of this transition. The beginning is clearly over, and we're still quite a ways from the end. If we look back over the last number of years, if we look at major studies which have been done about indigenous questions that are older than 15 years, you do not find comparative or international material. So If you go back to the Miriam Report in the United States in 1928, or the Hawthorne Report in Canada in 1966 and 1967, the Hun Report in New Zealand in the mid-60s, and three or four reports which have been done in Finland, Sweden, and Norway, you do not find comparative material, and even more so, the absence is even more striking, of any suggestions that there are any international law principles involved. More recent studies contain at least some comparative material. The report of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, well known to the chairman, is interesting in this. There were two international law opinions which were tabled to the inquiry from Professor Brownlee in the United Kingdom and Professor Falk in the United States, both of which argued that the international law principle of the self-determination of peoples applied to the Dene in the Northwest Territories. The end report used the term self-determination to describe the nature of the positions being put forward by the Dene and the Inuit in northern Canada. The report of the Woodward Inquiry in Australia contained some comparative material, and Judge Woodward came to Canada. The report of the Special Committee on Indian Self-Government in Canada, published in November of last year, again, the committee traveled to the United States. There was comparative material commissioned as in the background studies. And we see in the report of the Senate Committee in Australia, published also last fall, on the idea of a compact or makarata, that there you also get comparative material. It's a bit striking there that